Hello and thanks once again for taking the time to download and listen to our podcast on CelticUnderground.net. I'm Harry Brady and this is podcast number 211.
The game is over. The Rebels have won. Yeah!
Present directors who have controlled the destiny of Celtic for a generation have spent the day in crisis session. Tonight, Reporting Scotland understands that the Canadian millionaire, Fergus McCann, will join the board along with Dominic Keane.
Hello, the board of Celtic Football Club has tonight been dismantled.
Ooh, yes it is.
Compensation packages have been agreed with the resigning directors, which gives us the share control necessary to ensure the refinancing of the club and a solid financial base for the future.
I don't know what's up there.
The morality among people like Michael Kelly is something I think to be despised.
I know, change has gotta come. Oh, yes, it is.
They had a deadline at noon that day, and that's why I came overnight from I knew only two days warning. I came over from overnight from Phoenix to be there and to be at the bank on the day to provide, and in fact, do that at the time when I did not have control. I had to put up money in terms of debt. No guarantee of getting repaid.
I said, mother, I'm down on my knees.
Director, from June 14th, I gave notice to Mr. Luigi McCary that he had failed to meet important obligations under his contract of employment, and he was dismissed from his position as manager of the club.
So as you probably guessed, this week's podcast is going to be a wee bit different from past ones, and it's trying to be a celebration of the last 20 years since the Rebels won. There's some old podcast clips with Matt McGlone and Brian Dempsey. There's also a couple of Celtic wikis about Fergus McCann's time and his battles with the SFA and how he came to take over the club. And there's just a celebration of 20 years. Because let's be honest, a club was saved by Fergus, Brian Dempsey, Celts for Change, Gerald Weisfeld, Michael McDonald, everybody who was around at that particular time stopped our club from the ignominy of administration and saved it. So that everything we've experienced in the last 20 years has been down to what everybody involved in the Celts for Change, Fergus McCann, the Rebels did in March 1994. So sit back and enjoy the next wee while of clips and music and goals. This is me, Harry Brady, with all these guys.
The Rebels have won. Another slice of Celtic history from the Celtic Wiki. March the 4th, 1994 will go down as one of the most significant dates in Celtic history. That was the day when the battle to save Celtic was finally won. After a long and arduous fight, it was Fergus McCann and his millions which would steal the headlines. The exiled local boy made good, heroically leading the cavalry over the hill to save the day. But while McCann certainly deserves his share of the plaudits, the momentum for change did not come from the world of finance or big business. It came from the terraces. While McCann and men like Brian Dempsey and David Lowe were the public faces of the Parkhead coup, it was the ordinary supporters who had opened the door for their takeover. What these fans lacked in finances, they made up for in passion and a love of the club. Their rallies, their demonstrations, and even their boycotts would be every bit as important in the fight for Celtic as the millions of McCann. That fateful day brought to an end a near century of control of the club by two families. By the early 1990s, concerns about the Kelly and White dynasty, which had controlled the club for so long, had been growing. Since the failure to invest in their 1988 double winning side and the Mo Johnston signing fiasco, the support were becoming increasingly worried about the board's ability to compete with the big spending Rangers. The lack of investment was obvious on and off the pitch, and there existed a real fear the current custodians were incapable of adapting to the modern football environment. An historical policy of prudence had meant that the boys had failed to fully capitalise on the glory days of the Steen era. Now the club were being left behind by the aggressively ambitious Rangers. On the pitch, commercially, and in terms of stadium facilities, Celtic were an embarrassingly distant second to their city rivals. In May 1990, the club had brought onto the board Michael Kelly from the dynastic Celtic family and an outsider in Brian Dempsey. Kelly, a politician turned PR guru, and the successful property developer Dempsey were hailed by supporters as bringing much needed marketing and financial expertise to the board. With the post-Hillsborough Taylor report sounding the death knell for Celtic Park and its vast terraces, Dempsey, a Lanarkshire-born Celtic fanatic, was hoping to convince the board that the club should move to a purpose-built stadium in Rodbroyston. However, relations between Dempsey and Michael Kelly deteriorated. With various board members suspicious of Dempsey's intentions surrounding Rodbroyston, Kelly and fellow director Chris White made their play to have a property developer removed from the Parkhead Inner Circle. They were successful, and just 5 months after his appointment, Dempsey was ousted. Little did they know at the time, but the board had just drawn first blood in the civil war for the future of Celtic. As the team stumbled from one drearily woeful season to another, the frustration of support turned increasingly to anger. The years of mismanagement had left many fans at breaking point, and with the very future of the club at stake, the decision was made to take on the board and end generations of Kelly and White rule. It was not an easy decision for those supporters to make. They were only too aware of the club's traditions and the fact that the Whites and Kellys had links dating back to the very first Celtic side. Indeed, these two families had played a significant part in establishing Celtic as a truly great name in football. But there was little point in having a proud history if you had no future. Save Ourselves were the first supporters group to attempt to take on the board, and they were followed by the Independent Celtic Supporters Association. But it wasn't until the later emergence in 1993 of Celts for Change that fan power really began to change the course of Celtic history. Celts for Change employed a policy of direct action to highlight the club's plight. Their numbers quickly swelled, and demonstrations included a picket outside Celtic's then bankers, the Bank of Scotland. A boycott of a league clash with Kilmarnock at Parkhead on March 1, 1994, resulted in a pathetic attendance of around 8,300, while the board insisted the crowd was in the region of 10,800. This grassroots campaign for change was supported by leafleting in a thriving fanzine scene, but there did remain a small section of the support who were loyal to the board and who were initially dismayed at the tactics employed by Celts for Change and others. The board had tried to play on this by devious claiming Celts for Change and other supporter-led protests a little more than a vehicle for a bitter Brian Dempsey. There was no doubt that Dempsey, along with David Lowe, were too pressing for change at Celtic Park, but their takeover campaign, despite its shared aims, was born and run independently from that of Celts for Change. An increasingly divided board had clung desperately onto power, and the appointment of Terry Cassidy and David Smith, the club's first non-Catholic director, was seen as an attempt to add much-needed business acumen to their ranks. But with the very future of Celtic Park in doubt, time was quickly running out, and the hugely unpopular and abrasive Cassidy did little to enhance the board's reputation. Ambitious plans to relocate to a purpose-built Celtic village in Cambus Lang was the board's solution to the stadium issue. But doubts about the viability of the scheme, which was similar to Dempsey's Rob Royston project, had long been aired. In the meantime, a number of potential buyers for the club had emerged, the most credible of these being Fergus McCann. Roy Bourne, Canadian-based businessman, had made his millions through selling golf holidays to the North American market. He had the backing of Dempsey and proposed to rebuild Celtic Park by selling shares in the club to the support. A Celtic fan since childhood, McCann had originally approached the board in 1988 with an offer to provide the club with a low-interest loan to build a new two-tier executive stand in which he hoped to sell hospitality packages. His approach had been quickly dismissed. With the pressure mounting from all angles, the board announced a press conference for what they claimed would be the most momentous announcement in Celtic history. This announcement was no more than another unveiling for the Cambus Lang plans, with the board now claiming a Swiss bank was willing to finance the deal. However, a little digging from interested parties soon found that the supposed funding was non-existent. On March 3rd, with the reputation of a board at an all-time low and the club facing crippling debts, the Bank of Scotland summoned club officials and told them unless a guarantee of £1 million was found within 24 hours, then they would begin the process of winding up the club affairs. Finally, the board had no place to run and nowhere to hide. So it was that just before midday on March 4th, 1994, Fergus McCann became recognised as the saviour of Celtic. As Brian Dempsey would famously declare, "The rebels have won." But while it was the men in suits who took the plaudits and provided the sound bites for this Celtic revolution, the real heroes were not just those with money, but rather those with passion. The real heroes were those supporters on the terraces who began the coup to save the club they loved. They would not make millions from the battle to save Celtic, but they would earn the eternal gratification of a generation of hoop supporters.
So in these clips from the podcast number 42, which was approaching 4 or 5 years ago, Matt McGlone explains all about Celts for Change and how they galvanised the support. And it's really interesting listening when you put it in the context of what Rangers fans haven't done for their club.
Brendan Sweeney, who I didn't know, approached one of my fellows and said that you know, he was thinking of handing out leaflets, etc. And could you give me Matt's phone number, etc. I'd like to speak to him, etc. and see if we could get something going. So right about that same time, I was wanting to start an action group and I put an advert in the Sunday Mail, which cost about £90, saying if you care about your team, turn up at the City Halls, it's not all right. Or the next night, whatever it was, Monday or Tuesday, from the Sunday paper. A small advert, about the size of 2 postage stamps, and about 36 people turned up, and I think Brendan was one of them, and we had a chat, and I then put another advert in for a couple of weeks later, and couldn't believe it, walked up to the City Halls. There were 5 different rooms in the City Halls that you can hire. This was the smallest one, which should maybe hold 40, 50 people, And Brendan was in the crowd again and we spoke. As I walked up to the City Halls and the Candle Rigs, it was like going to a Celtic game. There was fans queued right round. I couldn't believe it. I thought, oof, this is taking off, unbelievable. After all, having 36 people at the first meeting. And we got a name organised and we tried to organise a committee that night. Brendan was certainly on the first committee. Brendan brought along a guy called David Cunningham, who they both went to school in Clydebank together. And Brendan and Davey were true soldiers, and the sort of there was myself and both of them. There were another couple of guys that came along that sort of fell away. And we just organised meetings as meetings went along, and we stabilised a five-man committee. And I started Celtic Dreams, ran it, and the five of us ran it. And myself, Colin Duncan, Brendan Sweeney, and John Thompson, and myself. Somebody had told me, I'm trying to think where this had came from, but somebody had told me that Brian Dempsey was going around trying to buy up Celtic shares, and one of the guys he had sort of hired, as it were, as a consultant to go and try buy up Celtic shares from the family. That was very difficult, because these people, those are rebels, if you want, Brian Dempsey at that time, slightly before Fergus came involved. Although both men had been in touch, Ferguson and McCann, at that time. But Brian had, I think, asked David Lowe, who was a football consultant, to go around the families, Kelly and Whites, and extended families, to see if they wanted to sell shares. They were offering them huge amounts of money, like £250 a share, when really these people didn't know the value of the shares. They didn't even think they were worth a pound. They thought they were hand-me-downs and should keep in their drawers, and their drawers as in their cabinets. And David went to great lengths. Anyway, I heard about this. At the same time, I was at the Glasgow University Celtic Supporters Club dinner, round about 93, and I saw Lowe in the toilet. I didn't know him, and I walked up, and standing at the urinal, says, "Hi, you David Lowe?" He said, "I said, I'm Matt McGuire, I do a magazine called Once or 2 Miles a Tin." I said, "I've heard that you're buying up shares on behalf of Brian Dempsey and other people. Is this true?" And he almost pissed his shiny new brogues, because I knew I'd hit a raw nerve. And he says, "When did you hear that?" And I says, I can't actually remember just now. I'd have to think about it. At that time, I wasn't telling him. And he says, "Listen, give me your number and I'll speak to you." Give me his number, and I met him the next day. And David Lowe at that time became involved in the sort of rebel group, and he was feeding information back via Fergus McCann and others to the Celtic for Change group and to the magazine that I ran Once or 2 Miles a Tin. So the magazine was well versed in information, and so was the Celtic for Change group.
For younger listeners, one of the things that Celtic for Change did was actively campaigned out to outside agencies to try and move things forward at Celtic. And again, unlike certain other clubs I could mention, it was a much more pragmatic approach and didn't involve going around and demanding to know people's names. So in the next bit, Matt goes on to explain a bit about the campaign against the Celtic bankers of the time, the Bank of Scotland.
I ran Celtic for Change, organised demonstrations, rallies, demonstrations outside the ground, demonstrations outside the Bank of Scotland, which used to be in Jaw Square, but is now a pub. And I remember that 350 turned up that day, and there was myself, I think Brendan was working, couldn't get away. It was difficult for the lads, it was difficult for all of us. But these four guys, the other four guys in Celtic for Change, are absolute heroes. I mean, we're all still big mates. Half of us sit together to this day, but none of us actually knew each other when things started. But the other four guys were absolutely unbelievable. The amount of work they did in organising and doing things was fantastic, and they deserved a fantastic pat on the back for all their work. But on that day, I remember it was Colin Duncan, myself, and Davey had went along, and we had got banners made up. Bank of Scotland stopped backing up a bankrupt club, etc., because we knew the club were insolvent. And we knew that the one way we'd win this battle is that this board, or the old board, weren't going to pay any of the debt. So we thought, well, something's going to happen here. There's going to be a crunch time. And I felt that the fans could play a part here in bringing down the old board. Which is a bit of a contradictory term, because you're asking fans not to go to a particular game, which was incredibly, incredibly difficult to see and also to pull off, because it was like saying, well, if you do this just now, it'll hurt just now for you, not going to again. But the future will be fantastic. The future will be 100 times better. But this was all in the melting pot to build up to a time, and you couldn't just stand up and say, hi, this helps for change. Don't go to that game in 2 weeks' time and everything will be fine. It took 6 months to get to Boycott, and a hell of a lot of work in between. Had to be outside the bank, Davy Ryan into the bank, asked to see the manager. The manager, the girl said, oh, he's not in. What is that about? And I said, well, there's 350 people outside. You know, we represent a group called Celtic for Change. I would just like to put a point to the manager just to listen to where we are, what we're about and where we're coming from, and ask him a question as to why he's continually backing up the club, who have no chance of paying this debt. And there's a real danger signal here. We are saying that the bank could take the club over as somebody else more sinister. As a Celtic fan, you always think somebody else more sinister could come in and, you know, try and mess about with our culture. So she said he wasn't in, and I said, well, there's 350 people outside. They're all going to come in and open up an account that's £1. They're all going to go back out again, and they're going to come back in and close that account. It will cause total utter chaos in your bank. And she kind of looked at me like I was out of an asylum. And Davy said, yeah, that's right, that's what's going to happen. She said, hang on a second. And about 3 minutes later, Davy and I were in, I think it was the assistant manager's office. We walked in, I thought, no matter what's said here, we've got a victory here. Walked in, made the point, asked the question that I said, why are you doing this? You know, what's the end product of all of this? How long are you going to let this run? What if they won't pay the money back? Who's going to take it over? What's your interest in all of this? Is there any other interest? And basically, he said, well, you know, I'll have to just take a board of your point of view and see what's going to happen here, and, you know, I'll pass this further on, and very nice, etc. But we made the point. We came out, and David and I both spoke to ITV and BBC, and both channels ran that at 6 and 6.30 that evening, and the Celtic for Change group get massive publicity of that they were taking strong action against people who were damaging Celtic Football Club.
One of the important things about Celtic for Change was that it was the movement that transformed the supporters into getting behind the business community who eventually took over the club. And the really important thing was that the way that that movement happened, all of us, I went to Shelton Town Hall meetings, etc., all of us felt that we could make a difference. It wasn't just, what can I do as an ordinary fan? And Matt goes on to explain.
Well, demonstrations at the city halls were heavily publicised and televised, but we never allowed the cameras in to those things. We were always outside, and you could see the strength of the movement, the strength of the feeling, the depth of emotion of people going in there and wanting to make their points felt. If you're standing on a stage and there's 2,500 people sitting in front of you on a Tuesday night at 8 o'clock with a Celtic scarf on and a Celtic strip, and you're talking and you're making the point, the energy that comes from that, and from all of us, we all felt it on the stage. I continually said to the boys afterwards, we're going to do this. We're going to do this. This is going to happen. Look at the fans. Look at the response. Their energy is unbelievable. That old board cannot withstand that energy. And it was, don't get me wrong, it was a hell of a campaign to be involved in. I mean, we all were almost wrecked at the end of it. Relationships were wrecked. I interviewed all the boys in the recent issue of Alternative View. You know, 15 years later, how do you feel? And I think most of them all said that, you know, there was relationship costs here, personal damage done, because you weren't there, you weren't doing the things you should have done your family. You were neglecting your kids, your wife, you're neglecting your friends. You know, you're neglecting so many things. But we were so focused. This was a train we weren't getting off. You couldn't get off it. You couldn't get off it. We were driving forward. And I knew within my heart and soul, and all the lads knew as well, that we could do this. And it was one demonstration, one rally after another, one Sunday meeting, one midweek meeting at the city halls. We didn't have any money to pay for this. We put a bucket round. It was something like £450 back in 1993 to pay for a hall. We then have two ball between us. And we put a bucket round. We got a couple of people who knew guys that were church, Catholic church elders. Not that there was any kind of religious thing, but people who were trusted with a bucket could walk round, and fans were throwing in 10 pence, 5 pence, 20 pence, £2, £5, £10, and everything was covered. Every meeting we had was covered. We had a bank account, we had a trustee in the bank account, we paid for banners, we paid for placards, we paid for anything, and eventually we called for a boycott. Celtic against Kilmarnock in late February, and lo and behold, there was a snowstorm the night before, and the game was called off. You can imagine working up to a boycott, all the work that took, all the organising, having everything in place. Funny enough, there was a game on at Love Street that day, and they managed to play their game because they wanted to play the game. Celtic looked at the snow in the pitch and thought, what a godsend. Cut a long story short, the game against Kilmarnock was then replayed on Wednesday, March the 2nd, 1994, and we had everything back in place for the boycott. We had a company called Scott Search, who we hired, and they had somebody standing at every single entrance at the old Celtic Park. And there was, you wouldn't believe they meant turnstiles at the old Celtic Park, but they seemed to be everywhere. But we had somebody through that company standing there, and they clicked every single person in. There was 8,225 people late to that game. That's 8,225, and there was something like 1,550 Kilmarnock fans. The official attendance, we always thought the break point for the board was 10,000. Lo and behold, the next day they came out and said the attendance was 10,055 or something. It was ridiculous. It was embarrassing. The official attendance was 8,225. I was given a document by Scott Search. We knew the board would say it'd be over 10,000 rather. I was on Sports Scene that night with Hazel Irvin on the National News holding up a document saying there was 8,225 people at the game. I asked the board to challenge this if they felt I was telling a lie. Of course, they couldn't challenge it and were proved right yet again. That broadcast was then taken up by all the papers the next day, and the challenge was the Celtic board challenged these fans to say there was more than 10,000 people at that game, or in fact more than 8,225. So if there's 1,550 Kilmarnock fans, you're talking about 6,500, that kind of thing, Celtic fans at that game. Now, when you look at the crowds we get today, that was a response from the fans, and from that point I smelt victory, and I could smell it within days, and it happened 2 days later. The bank called Celtic in on the Thursday and said, what's happening here? Who's going to pay the debt here? We've got all these rebel groups standing aside, we've got a Celtic for Change pressure group, we've got McCann and Dempsey saying they'll pay money here, there and everywhere. They've offered to buy the shareholders out. Some are saying yes, some are saying no. What happened was Tom Grant, Jack McGinn, Jimmy Farrell and Kevin Kelly all jumped ship, which left David Smith and Michael Kelly and Chris White, three of them. They wanted money. They disgracefully, on March the 4th, in the boardroom, sat there and wanted money for a club, money for shares at a club that was bust. They wanted to take money out of the club when there was no money in the club. What they had achieved was they created a debt, but they wanted money out of a club which had no money for a debt they created. A bit like Sir Fred Goodwin at the moment. You know, created a hellish situation but walking away with money. And the witnesses in that meeting, when the deal was getting done on March the 4th, on the evening of March the 4th, when they were outside, with thousands of fans outside, chanting, Celtic board out, Celtic board out. They were on the rocks. McCann and Dempsey were in there with a few other people. A guy from the Celtic board just now, John Keane. John Keane is a wonderful Celtic fan who has been on successive Celtic boards since the takeover in 94, who has always put money in and he's wanted nothing out. He's put money in at a time when he knew his shares would go down, but he's such a big fan, he just wanted to be part of it and still is to this day. They were all in there. Tom Grant told me recently in an interview I did with him in the Alternative View that David Smith was working some kind of deal, possibly allegedly, with the Bank of Scotland. And, you know, that even gets more sinister when you think the bank couldn't stop lending Celtic money in their overdraft. And that David Smith is a former employee of theirs and would have been part, possibly, of something in the way of a takeover when the bank wanted their money back. That, to me, is worrying. And I only found that out 3 or 4 weeks ago.
So once Fergus was successful, the Celts for Change, just a few days later, had a victory rally, and that was an amazing event with an atmosphere that was up there with a victory over Rangers?
The victory rally was, we had to hire the hall maybe 10, 14 days in advance to get it. So that was actually a rallying call rally, because we didn't maybe expect it to all fall so quickly. But once the previous Wednesday Kilmarnock game had happened, we knew it would. The bank looked at the crowd, and the bank realised then, after we'd paid them a visit, and after, obviously, not just us, but obviously because Dempsey and McCann were talking, you know, to various people in financial circles, that they were ready to put money in. The bank looked at that crowd and thought, this is serious. These fans are not turning up. Mm-hmm. You know, over 6,500 Celtic fans, you know, turning up when you take into the fact there was 1,550 Kilmarnock fans there. So anyway, back to the point, yeah, that rally, that was actually a rallying call. We had arranged a couple of weeks earlier, which we very quickly turned into a victory rally. That was at 7:30 that night, or 7 o'clock, and there was 3,000 people in that hall by 5:30, by 6 o'clock, hours before it. We had Wee Jinky, God rest him, up on the stage. We had Bobby Murdoch, God rest him, up on the stage. We had Bertie Auld.
Amazing to think about it now, but at that victory rally were two journalists who were considered to be very proactive in helping the cause of the fans. Jim Traynor was one of them, and Matt goes on to explain who the other was.
We also had, this is a cringer, we also had Hugh Keevans introducing people on. Now, I have to explain it at this juncture. You know, that's going back 15 years. Mm-hmm. The Hugh Keevans and the Jim Traynors that we know now weren't phone-in guys and tabloid guys at that time. There were no phone-ins, and both of those guys, one was in the Herald, that was Traynor, and Keevans was with the Scotsman. Our view then, which would be most fans' view then, was that they were pushing the rebel group's point. So therefore, that was our view of them at that point, and that's when they did that. Our view of them now is much different, obviously. You know, both of these guys were broadsheet writers, who were very supportive of the campaigns. So, you know, Keevans, to his credit then, you know, I don't have much time for the individual now, but at that time, you know, he did push the rebel change through the Scotsman, and so did Traynor. So, you know, that was the reasons for that, and obviously, you know, I'm happy about that. That night, it was almost like Brian Dempsey. Willie Hawkey was on the stage, sitting to my right. He was delivering a very fine speech. He was part of the, although he wasn't part of the McCann Dempsey thing, he was part of the whole rebel outlook and the whole campaign, but he wasn't part of McCann Dempsey. But he was still a rebel, he still wanted the board out, and, you know, Willie was obviously playing his part at the time, on with him and Gerard Whitefield, who were a sort of rival. Gerard Whitefield, who doesn't know, was a very rich individual who used to own What Every Woman Wants, which is a clothing chain. And he ran side by side with Willie Hawkey. Anyway, Willie was on the stage delivering his piece, in walks Brian Dempsey. In my opinion, yes, it was deliberate. He walked in, as like part of the Red Sea. There was people standing in the aisles, there was people sitting on top of each other, there was people standing up at the back of the City Hall. There's pictures to prove it. The place was jumping, health and safety, right out the window that night, if it even existed at the time. In walks Brian Dempsey, bodies partied right, left and centre, and a huge roar went up. Willie's speech was completely and utterly drowned out. And when it all calmed down and Brian took to the stage, I was trying not to laugh. I was trying to figure out what was going on. I did feel like the stage managed. Somebody told me that David Lowe pressed a button on his mobile phone, which in those days, 1994, were big giant things like big transmitters that you'd, you know, Zed Victor 1 talkie-talkie things, walkie-walkies. And somebody told me that David Lowe pressed a button and Brian Dempsey got the message outside and walked in when Willie was doing his speech. Willie, to his eternal credit, he stood there, and I remember clearly what he said. I don't care who you are, I don't care who's walked in here, I'm carrying on. And he did. But that night, victory rally, yeah, it was like a victory against Rangers. It was a wonderful, wonderful evening, and it came in the Monday after the Friday takeover, which would have been the 7th, and it was a great atmosphere and a fantastic night and the end of the campaign and a huge sigh of relief.
Van Hooijdonk going in! Celtic have scored! And Van Hooijdonk, who makes a habit of getting the goals on the big occasion, has got it again.
differences.
Van Hooydonk, Cadet, Di Canio, they have scored!
Nothing will keep us together. We can beat them.
That's loud! Lining up for the shot! What a start for Celtic! 2 minutes gone! And Lawson makes the breakthrough! In for Harold Brandbach! He's done it! Harold Brandbach scores the goal, which may well give Celtic the title!
Larsson. Oh, he's in! Henrik Larsson! That is sensational! And it's turned in by Chris Sutton!
Just for one day.
Sutton is there! Yes, they have! Sutton scores! It's six of the best for the very best today, Celtic!
Brilliant from Sean Maloney! What a goal!
And we kissed.
McDonald!
I can't even speak. It's been a fantastic year, and it's just great to be part of something special like this. And
sensational from a sensational player.
Come here to Juventus in our opening game of the Champions League and play like we did. Second half was extraordinary. Extraordinary. And we've gone and got a decision like that there. It's absolutely extraordinary. We were magnificent. Magnificent. Coming roaring in there against Juventus who spent £100 million and we were fantastic.
To the back post, and it's Thompson.
Left-footed corner, in towards the far post, header it! It's a goal for Celtic! Wanyama has put them in front! goes through. Precisely what Celtic need. Celtic 1, Barcelona 0.
Yes, a wonderful start for Celtic.
Here comes Tony Watt. What a moment for Watt!
Yes!
Recall that 2.5 to 3 years ago, Eddie Pearson and I met with Brian Dempsey. Well, with it being the 20th anniversary podcast, it's not all about Fergus. So we've had Matt McGlone giving us a fantastic insight into the part that we, the fans, played in making sure that Celtic kept trading and existing and playing football, unlike other football clubs. And here is some of the more salient parts of our conversation with Brian Dempsey from 2 to 3 years ago. If you heard it last time, it's not the whole thing, so there'll be some interesting bits that you might have forgotten. If you didn't hear it last time, it's a great insight into that wonderful time at our club. Worrying though,
it was a Wednesday night. I knew things were really bad, and I'd heard rumours. I didn't know how bad they were. And that there were two European games on, the second of which was Arsenal playing. It could have been Real Madrid from memory. So the games went on until midnight. And immediately the Arsenal game finished, that's at bed, the phone went. And I was being hounded by the press, by everybody. So this would be the morning edition, so I thought, what is it now, hello? And it was Kevin Kelly. And he said, Brian, Kevin Kelly. Now, this was a surprise. He hadn't spoken to me in years. They'd walk past me at Celtic Park, they would ignore me, scared to be seen saying hello to me. I said, Kevin, it's a strange time of night for you to call. Were you watching the games? I said, yes. Wasn't that a great goal? And he started talking about these two games and going on and on. Eventually, I said, Kevin, listen, I'm normally an early bedder. I'm renowned for being an early bedder because I was always first. I had to be first in to show an example at work. I said, I really should be in my bed. Can you tell me what I can do for you? And these were his words. He said, look, we've got a wee problem. If we don't have £1 million in the bank by 5 o'clock tomorrow, the club will be put into receivership. And I paused for a minute and I said to him, and that's a wee effing problem. So he'd watched these two games all night. He could have phoned me at 6 o'clock after the board meeting finished. They ended it so they could rush home and see the football, a lot of them, he told me. He waited all night to phone me at midnight, tell me they've a problem tomorrow. And that is exactly how they ran the club. So when I went in at 9 o'clock, I literally had 3 hours to appease a bank, by which time the bank had already appointed the receiver. Mm-hmm. They had appointed Noble Grossart to come in at 5 o'clock as receivers. And I have to say the bank were utterly excellent with me. And I said, well, I can't put £1 million in without having guarantees from the present shareholders that they'll not take the money and keep it. I've got to have guarantees and I'm not getting them. And he said, look, if you give us a guarantee by 5 o'clock tomorrow night, we'll wait 6 weeks for the cash. They were wonderful. That's what happened. Because I then had 6 weeks to get them into place. I then phoned Fergus, who said he wasn't coming back, he'd had enough of them. But I know someone phoned them behind the scenes and said, this is it, and he landed in. Or he might never have come back.
So after giving us an insight as to how suddenly the call to move in and save the club to the Rebels came from the existing board, Brian Dempsey then went on to provide Eddie and I with a bit more insight into the technical mechanics of how that came about, and then a flavour of some of the meetings that happened in that night, 20 years ago
share of the votes
today.
And I had now, at one point, you know, I owned about 35% of Celtic. I had people, I had Jim Craig up in Fockhamers or somewhere with a £100,000 draft, somebody down in England with £100,000 buying up the proxies, not the shares, because the board wouldn't approve the shares, mm-hmm, transfer, the proxies. So we had lifetime proxies here, it was all going round. And we got an EGM where we had about 28% of the vote, but we didn't want the EGM, the extraordinary general meeting. When you call an extraordinary general meeting, it gives you the right to examine the company books. And this guy went through the company books and found from something like 1947 or 1951 or something, no share transfer in Celtic had been executed lawfully. They had used the wrong amount of money, paying the stamp duty. Now, it was something like £1 or 10 shillings. Mm-hmm. Celtic being Celtic, guess what they did? Took the 10 shillings, but it should have been £1. And every share transfer had been wrong. So we went back and cancelled every transfer to 1951, called a second EGM, bought in some of these new shares properly, bang. Still tight, but I never thought we would win it that night, but I thought we really scared one, and we won it. That's the night they wanted to move Jimmy Fowle from and Tom Grant from the board. Now, if I'd be honest about that, the minute Jimmy Fowle and Tom Grant were kept on that board, they started signing out the same hymn sheet as the board. They never became rebel directors or anything like that. They immediately towed the line. That's my criticism of them. Jimmy and I were long, long friends, and I said to him, no, Fergus McCann couldn't stand Jimmy Fowle for that, because he felt as a professional, he should have known how best to deal with that. And that was not to acquiesce and just toe the line completely. But that's how we got to the point of saving them, and suddenly, that night, and somebody got up and started saying, a friend of mine's there to Jolly Good Fellows, if they hadn't done that, we were poised to move a vote of no confidence in the chairman and have him removed. At that time, I also acquired an interdict on the shares that were improperly. That day, had to time it to that day, got the judge in his house in Edinburgh when he came off the golf course, had to time it to perfection. And I was sitting with Michael Kelly, and I think Kevin Kelly, Tom Grant was there, Jimmy Fowle and myself, in their accountant's office in Glasgow, with them saying, what is it you guys want? Do you want back on the board, Brian? I said, Michael, I want nothing. You have done the worst of all things. You have created an enemy who wants absolutely nothing but victory. And that's what they had done. So they got a phone call saying, there's been an interdict in so many shares. I could see the panic in their faces, saying, we have to go, they've interdicted these shares. They left the room, and I put my feet up in their accountant's room, and I said, well, can somebody tell me what really happens now? Because we didn't really know. Mm-hmm. We went to the meeting that night. Alec Cameron, who was doing STV work, said, after speaking to me, a man who looks like he's facing defeat. Because he said to me, do you think you'll win? I said, I honestly don't know. Are you not confident? I said, I wouldn't be confident in a situation like this, because we had to get Ernst Young in to analyse all these shares. They took about 4 hours. We couldn't have the meeting. We had to sit and sit and sit. I know that Michael Kelly went into the room to talk to them, and they put him out. Out, you're not allowed, nobody's allowed in here, to try and make head and tail of this. But we won that night, and I felt there was a big crowd outside. And at one time, it stays long, I went down and in among the crowd and talked to them, and just said, you know, that this could be a long night, don't hang about, don't wait, the rain could come on, but you know Celtic supporters are immovable. And we chatted away, and I went upstairs, and when it was announced, I was slow off my feet to move the vote of no confidence, because my immediate thought went to those people outside. I really thought and felt for them. One of the press guys said to me afterwards, how do you feel? Do you take this as a personal victory? You'll find this on the record then. I said, absolutely not. This is a victory for every Celtic supporter who wants to see change, especially those standing outside all night. And he stood there.
As most of you will know, Glasgow's a village, and any story rapidly goes round the business world. And of course, if there's not a story to go around the business world, then people just make that up and that eventually becomes the fact. So one of the things that Eddie and I wanted to know was, after all of this, when for 3-4 years, Brian Dempsey was pretty much the leader of the rebel fans and the rebel business people, why did the club move forward with Fergus and Brian Dempsey pretty much disappear? So here's what Brian...
Well, I've never admitted this. I kind of broke my heart. I made the wrong choice. I said to Fergus, the two of us couldn't be there. He offered me directorship. Mm-hmm. And I said I thought it would be a bad idea for the club. The press would always be looking for me to contradict him, and that I would continue to be the rebel director had been. And I decided to move abroad said it was for tax reasons, didn't really work that way, to justify my being abroad, but I just stepped out of the limelight immediately. He was very glad I did, because I was always a very serious competing factor, and you have to understand this, the press did not get on with Fergus, so I was guaranteed to be the next man they come to. What do you think of that? I was not capable of saying, I can't talk about that, I'm really sorry. I wouldn't show that kind of weakness. So I wouldn't do that to the club, and I stepped back.
A takeover on that says a set of images and words that are seared into the mind of every Celtic supporter who saw it, staying up late at night before the age of the internet and mobile phones, for most of us, sitting in front of the television, the STV news comes on. It cuts to the car park and the front steps at Celtic Park. It's pouring with rain. There's a guy standing on someone's shoulders with an oversized umbrella. There's another guy wearing a Haddo's poly bag on his head as a hat. And Brian Dempsey in his Mac and Fergus McCann in his bonnet come to the steps. And Brian Dempsey stands and says, well, I'll let Brian tell you about it.
We were sitting at dinner and Fergus said to me, here's a great line for you. And he said, the game is over, the Rebels have won. And I said, you do it. No, I can't do that. I'm not good at that. You do it. So I went out and the police said, try and let the people know quickly that it's all done and all over and let everybody go home. And he said, including my officers.
My message to Celtic supporters everywhere tonight is simply this. The game is over. The Rebels have won. Yeah!
Fergus versus Farry. Another slice of Celtic history from the Celtic Wiki. In the supposedly paranoid mind of the average Celtic fan, there has long been a deep-rooted suspicion of the motives of the Scottish Football Association. This suspicion of the National Association was born from incidents such as the infamous flag flutter and a perceived bias against Celtic players in the selection of the Scotland squad. But by the early 1990s, many Celtic fans were willing to accept that if such outright bias existed, it was in a bygone age. But a remarkable series of clashes between SFA head Jim Farry and Celtic chief executive Fergus McCann fanned the flames of suspicion once more. SFA chief Farry, a former landscape gardener, and McCann were certainly contrasting characters. Barry cherished the red tape bound world of football administration. He revelled in its complex committee structure and the seemingly endless lists of rules and regulations. In contrast, the straight talking McCann thought Scottish football was overburdened by needless bureaucracy and contradictory legislation, which he believed merely hindered progress. To the successful go getting entrepreneur, the SFA appeared antiquated and self serving. From the minute McCann walked through the parkhead doors, a showdown was inevitable. The first clash would come in July 1994, with the appointment of Tommy Burns as Celtic manager. Burns and assistant Billy Stark had resigned from their managerial roles at Kilmarnock so they could complete the move to paradise. In a rather undignified affair, things were complicated further by the fact both had already been registered as players for the Rugby Park club. Kilmarnock were furious with what they saw as Celtic's underhand methods, and the Scottish League and the SFA were strongly sympathetic to the Ayrshire side. Celtic would be fined by the league £100,000 for poaching of the duo, and would also be ordered by the SFA to pay double that amount in compensation. It was now McCann's turn to be furious. He argued the scale of a fine imposed by the league and supported by Farry and the SFA was unprecedented, and pointed out that when Rangers tapped up Dundee United's Duncan Ferguson, They were given a punishment of just £5,000. Ultimately, McCann had no option but to stump up the cash. While the fine certainly seemed excessive, almost all outsiders sided with the league and the SFA. Many in football and the media had been appalled by McCann's behaviour. Throughout the whole affair, at no time did he even show the slightest regret for his blatant tapping of Burns. The redevelopment of Celtic Park would spark round two, Fergus versus Farrey. When McCann drew up the proposals for the stadium rebuild, he was told by the SFA Stadium Committee that Celtic would have no choice but to play away from Parkhead for a season. The advice was given on legitimate safety grounds, but McCann was uneasy with the fact that SFA could make such a decision, given that they, along with Queen's Park, would benefit financially from Celtic's temporary move to Hampden. McCann was further infuriated when he learnt that Celtic would not only have to pay an annual rent of £600,000, but the landlords would also be the ones who'd be raking the cash from catering and programme sales. In a bid to make the National Stadium a little bit more homely, the boys had hoped to add a few temporary touches to the changing rooms and the ground, which would give it a slightly more Celtic flavour for the Hoops' home games. But their requests were refused. It was obvious to McCann and Celtic that while their money was very welcome, the actual presence at Hampden was barely tolerated. McCann had become a frequent and vocal opponent of the SFA's proposals to redevelop Hampden. The multi-million pound revamp of the National Stadium was Farrey's pet project. Fergus was only too keen to let it be known that millions of pounds of public money would be wasted creating what he called the third best ground in Glasgow. The final battle between the two would be a long and bitter struggle. It started in February 1996 when Celtic, pushing for a league and cup double, attempted to bolster their squad with the signing of Sporting Lisbon striker George Cadet. Transfers, which involve a player moving from one country to another, are frequently far from straightforward. And this being the case, Celtic kept the SFA fully updated with developments. When on February the 26th, a personal agreement was reached with a player, Celtic forwarded all the required paperwork to the SFA. No concerns were raised by the SFA, so when the international clearance certificate arrived on March the 7th and was forwarded to the national body, it was assumed the transfer would be processed as a matter of course. However, the SFA now expressed concerns about the compensation arrangements between Celtic and Sporting, and Farrey claimed that until these were resolved, he regarded the international clearance certificate as invalid. The SFA then informed Celtic that because Cadet had also entered into a separate financial arrangement with Sporting regarding his payoff, the original player agreement was unsatisfactory. They subsequently asked Celtic to make a number of specific changes. These were done, but when the club submitted a revised agreement, it was returned by the SFA, who were now unhappy with various other points of the deal that they had previously had no issue with. Meanwhile, a fax from FIFA to the SFA stated that having looked at the details of the deal, they had no concerns, and the international clearance certificate should be regarded as valid from March the 7th. An SFA management meeting accepted this, but amazingly, Celtic were ordered once more to make changes to their personal agreement with the player, as the SFA yet again voiced concerns about elements of the contract they had previously had no worries about. On March the 30th, Celtic were once more forced to make changes to the agreement. But at last, the transfer was registered and cleared. However, the SFA now refused to backdate their ratification of the transfer, meaning Cadet missed a 2-1 Scottish Cup defeat to Rangers. When the striker was finally able to take to the field, he would score 5 goals in 6 games. It was, however, not enough to maintain Celtic's challenge for silverware. And with Rangers securing an 8th successive league title, angry Hoops fans were left wondering what might have been if Cadet's registration had not been delayed. During the period of the delay, Celtic had played and drawn two league games, 1-1 at Rangers and 0-0 at Motherwell. McCann was raging at his seemingly needless delay and stalling in the processing of the transfer. Barry was held personally responsible by McCann, and the Celtic chief was not prepared to let the matter rest, even if it meant carrying on the fight after his tenure at Parkhead was over. Unlike many Hoops fans, McCann let it be known that he didn't perceive the delay in cadets' registration as being the result of any specific anti-Celtic bias. Rather, he stated it was a simple but intolerable example of ineptitude at the very highest level. Two internal SFA investigations cleared Farry of any wrongdoing, but McCann was not to be placated so easily. From 3 years after the affair, and after McCann had departed Celtic, the Canadian-based businessman finally got the independent inquiry he was after. The media had again lambasted McCann for what they believed was a paranoid-fueled witch hunt. But after just one day of the independent inquiry, they would be eating their words. Under cross-examination from Celtic's legal representative, Barry was dismantled. Even when presented with overwhelming evidence to the contrary, SFA chief stuck to his guns and insisted that everything about the deal was completed as per the established protocol. But with every word uttered, he merely dug himself into a deeper hole, and by the end of the day, his reputation and career was in tatters. The SFA conceded the case put forward by Celtic and acted with an ironic alacrity by immediately suspending Farry. Farry would be sacked for gross misconduct. He may have been the SFA's fall guy, but put simply, he had picked one fight too many with McCann, and he paid with his job. His exit was certainly greeted with delight by the Celtic support, but it was in truth scant consolation compared to the league title the club may have won.
Of course, there is one other story of the last 20 years, with its roots coming back as far as 1967, kicking in the early 90s, and really from the time of Fergus. A bit of cheating was required on their behalf. I am, of course, talking about the dream that Rangers had of trying to emulate the great Glasgow Celtic and the folly of David Murray. It is the Rangers story.
I never sit and go and think we've reached the peak. We've not reached the peak. The best is still to come. To a place we all know, the
land of make-believe. I move on from Rangers. I will leave it in the hands of people that I think have put the best into the club.
David Murray has been overly reckless, and this club is in real trouble, dire trouble.
Exciting.
Yeah. What's the main priority now?
The main priority is to win the match today.
Rangers introduced tax avoidance schemes to support their big money contracts. This would come back to haunt Rangers.
The taxman's taken all my dough.
This is a difficult day for Rangers, but we'll emerge the bitter and stronger club from this.
And I can't sail my yacht. He's taken everything I got. All I've got's this sunny.
The big house must stay open. That's the bottom line.
And, you know, when you look back at it, I like these two names, Dick Advocaat and Sir David Murray, along with something like Don Quixote and Sancho Panza, tilting at windmills on the assumption that they were too big to fail. Or, conversely, Laurel and Hardy, if it weren't so tragic.
Hello, good afternoon. Rangers Football Club, one of the most famous in Britain, has announced it's gone into administration.
140 years of history. Just start again now.
Worried, sick. It's a big embarrassment to the club. I think Mr. Murray and Mr. Bain have got a lot to answer for. I was just saying to someone else, it's not just the history of the club. It's the history of families that come here together.
Are you pretty upset? Well, give me two good reasons why
I ought to stay. Is there a threat of Rangers going bust and going out of existence?
I would say absolutely not.
Where's this money? I mean, it seems to have just completely disappeared.
We're heading in the direction of liquidation.
Rangers and its fans deserve better than that little googly.
The football continues, but there is a break in tradition. It will be a new Rangers.
Net debt, 82 million.
82 million net debt.
Well, last night we got a £29 million offer for Hooper. From an unknown agent, from an unknown club, from another universe.
Now, obviously, I can't let a 20-year Rebel anthology end on the Rangers, no matter how amusing that has been in the last couple of years. So, let's just get me straight. So, apart from stopping us going through administration, stopping us ever having to be liquidated, building a 60,000-seater stadium, stopping Rangers 9 in a row, winning a treble, getting to the last 16 of Champions League, just what else did we do in the last 20 years? Ah, that's right. As Chris Sutton's shot went agonisingly past the post, away in Basel, and we went out on the away goal rule and didn't qualify for the Champions League, who would have thought the run that we would have had, the joy that we would have had, all brought to us by the letter V.
Blast it, and he touches it over, and that is a goal by Juspokan.
Following the 10-1 aggregate against Sudover, it was boys against men in black. Inside.
Hearts it up. Oh, what a save by Finland. Henry Larsson was there, and Celtic have scored. Henrik Larsson has got the goal that means so much to Celtic on 85 minutes. Flamenco dance will stop by the finest bit. Oh, Henrik Larsson, surely, for Celtic. Yes, he has. He has scored for the second time in this tie. He rattled his maracas closed. Shut in. Oh, yes. On the ground where he scored so many for Blackburn Rovers, Chris Sutton probably settles this UEFA Cup tie for Celtic.
Next was Celta Vigo, where away goals did it.
That is a very good ball indeed, and it just comes away. Lawson got the touch. Celtic are one.
Larson with the free kick. Chris Sutton timed his jump well. John Hartson! Celtic have equalised! A brilliant finish from Hartson, 10 minutes from half-time. And is that the goal that points Celtic towards the last 16 of the UEFA Cup? Wing
is girlfriend. It was, and next up came the aggregate 5-4 against Stuttgart.
Thompson and Sadison, and a ball Maloney with a chance. He's done it! That's a good run by Petrov, got in behind the defensive chip. An astonishing goal by Petrov.
Three in the box for the cross, one is Hartson, another is Alan Thompson, who heads Celtic in front. You read the Spanish school, España, por favor. And Chris Sutton makes it two. Two goals in 3 minutes, and Celtic are cruising.
When you walk through the storm, hold your head up.
And Hartson gets a shot away and clips the bar on 12 seconds.
After drawing 1-1 at Celtic Park, we then went down to Anfield. A quite an incredible night.
Thompson, yes!
Semi-final, we drew one each at Celtic Park. They scored first through a Valharan own goal, and Henrik missed a penalty. But of course, we then went to Portugal for an incredible away game.
Oh, and it's sliced in by Phoenicians, the Carthaginians, the Romans, the Moors, all of whom
have dominated this particular area. I've never seen an invasion quite like this.
Your arms are too weary to reach the unreachable star.
And the boys in hoops at the start of the second half. And Larson's got away here. And he scores!
No matter how far, to fight for the right, without question or pause, to be willing to march into hell for a heavenly cause. And I know...
It's cutting a lot. It is Larson! He's still in! A good one was supplied. By heck it was.
The efforts this season have been absolutely phenomenal, and credit to the football club. And so are you. So, I just...
And the final say in Seville, it's surely got to go to Martin O'Neill.
By the time the four doctors come on and realised that the broken fingernail would be all right, he had wasted 4.5 minutes.